keepeth the covenant of peace and the everlasting priesthood. And so we call upon our brother Roger to lead us in that study.
Now, I do hope you've got both of the overheads, because I thought we might just start by reading the final overhead from session 5, which was, of course, the word of exhortation yesterday, just to summarise the principle that we saw, the wonderful principle, as Phinehas inspired the sons of Korah throughout their successive generations. And I thought we might, by way of introduction this morning, remind ourselves of the principle here expressed as zeal and the power of example. And so we read, zeal is a consuming ardour to exalt God. It involves both loving righteousness and hating wickedness. The zeal of one person's passionate endeavour in God's service can greatly influence others. Such is the power of example. Phinehas imbued the sons of Korah with his own stern devotion to holiness, his love of purity, his abhorrence of corruption, his own unswerving loyalty to the truth, his personal standard of excellence. His zeal was continued in the successive generations of a family that became his spiritual offspring. To light the flame in the generation to come is the greatest work of zeal, for in this is assurance that the truth will be preserved. And I think that's an excellent summary of the spirit of the story, you see, of Phinehas and his rulership over the sons of Korah. Wasn't that the greatest thing that he achieved? The perpetuation of the spirit of zeal in others, the nourishment of good, the lighting of the flame. That's something that we must all aspire to, isn't it? And so that brings us now, therefore, to the words that we've read this morning in Numbers chapter 25. And coming back to the 11th verse, as we had these words read this morning, and we remind ourselves, therefore, of the promise of the priesthood that was given to Phinehas. We're going to come back now and examine this promise of priesthood this morning, because a special promise it surely is. And so Numbers 25 and verse 10 says, "And Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, Phinehas the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, hath turned my wrath away from the children of Israel, while he was zealous with my zeal among them, that I consumed not the children of Israel in my zeal. Wherefore say, behold, I give unto him my covenant of peace, and he shall have it, and his seed after him, even the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God, and made an atonement for the children of Israel." And so this brings us then to the, well, really, let's just have a look at our four questions for this morning, shall we, on the sixth and final sheet. So what are the questions we want to look at this morning in terms of the matter of the priesthood that is now set before us? Well, the first question, I suppose, is this: does this promise relate to the natural seed of Phinehas only, or is there a further application to a spiritual seed of Phinehas as well? Is there a double application? Does it apply just to the one, just to the natural seed, or perhaps to a spiritual seed as well? Which is really very similar to the second question, isn't it? Does the covenant with Phinehas promise simply a mortal priesthood after the order of Aaron, or is this the promise of an eternal priesthood after the order of Melchizedek, or in fact is it a promise of both? And our third question, which we'll come to shortly in the book of Psalms, is exactly how would the action of Phinehas be counted unto him for righteousness, and on what basis would this be to all generations forevermore? It's taken from a passage in the Psalm that we'll come to shortly. And finally, what similarities are there between the covenant promise that's made to Phinehas in this 25th chapter of Numbers and the great covenant promises that we know were made to Abraham and to David on other occasions in the divine narrative. Well, what I'm going to do this morning, brothers and sisters, I need to explain myself, I think, carefully. You need to listen carefully this morning, actually, because we've got quite a lot of ground to cover. And it's one of these sort of tricky studies to follow in terms of getting notes down, because there's no easy passage. You see, we're not going to expound verse by verse here. There are no verses to expound particularly. What I'm going to do is this. I'm going to start by saying, let's make the whole matter very clear. I think that the promise of the priesthood in Numbers 25 is a promise for both a mortal priesthood and an immortal priesthood. That there are both applications to be found in the promise here of Numbers 25. I think this is a promise concerning the Aaronic priesthood and the priesthood after the order of Melchizedek. And what I'm going to do is take you through the reasoning or the arguments for both of those things, both of those ideas. So you won't need to write something down and cross it out later on. Both ideas are going to be right, you see. But when we come to the matter of the order of Melchizedek, what I'm going to do is this. I'm not going to try and give you a particularly... It's not a logical sequence of ideas, it's more what I might call a kaleidoscope. I'm going to take you through simply a whole potpourri of ideas that I think all beautifully relate the promise to Phineas here to the Melchizedek covenant. That this is the promise of an immortal priesthood. And I'm just going to just take you through some thoughts, really, that I've had on why that is so in Numbers chapter 25. And then at the end of all that, we're going to try and bring it all together, gather all the threads together and weave them into the final tapestry of what Phineas's life is all about. So let's start with the Aaronic promise then, shall we? That hidden in these verses, he shall have it and his seed after him, the covenant of an everlasting priesthood. Is there an application of this to the Aaronic order? And you see, I think the answer is, well, yes, there has to be. There certainly is. In fact, you notice this. If you come back to Exodus chapter 40 for a moment, notice these words that are given to the house of Aaron concerning the priesthood after the order of Aaron, Exodus chapter 40. Perhaps reading from verse 12. It says, "Thou shalt bring Aaron and his sons unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and wash them with water, and thou shalt put upon Aaron the holy garments, and anoint him, and sanctify him, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office. And thou shalt bring his sons, and clothe them with coats." Now that's interesting. You see that word coats? That's the very word for the coats in which Nadab and Abihu were carried out in Leviticus 10. These are the priestly coats of ministration. Thou shalt clothe them with coats, and thou shalt anoint them, verse 15, as thou didst anoint their father, that they may minister unto me in the priest's office, for their anointing shall surely be, and here's the phrase we want, an everlasting priesthood throughout their generations. You see that phrase, everlasting priesthood? Do you know that that's only found in one other place in the Bible? And where might that be? But Numbers 25. "Wherefore I give unto him the covenant of an everlasting priesthood." That's the only two times in the Bible that phrase is found. So whatever other application there may be to the promise of Numbers 25, there has to be a reference here, at least to the priesthood of Aaron that was promised to this family. And so the word everlasting here, of course, is a word that could mean truly eternal or everlasting, in the sense that this priesthood would last throughout the whole period of the Jewish Olam, would it not? And every high priest after the order of Aaron would successively hold that priesthood, and it would remain in that family throughout their generations, so that it truly was held by them forever. For the entire length of the Jewish Olam, this would be an everlasting priesthood. And you see, when you see the promise of Numbers 25 in that way, I think that even the words of Malachi do seem to support the idea that the promise has relationship to the Aaronic order. Because you know what Malachi says? We won't turn it up this morning, but you know what Malachi says? He says, he talks about my covenant with Levi. This commandment is for you, O priest, that my covenant might be with Levi. I gave unto him a covenant of life and peace. And the covenant of life and peace, which we know in Malachi was really the promise to Phinehas, is taken up in Malachi as the promise of a priesthood to the house of Levi. That's got to be the Aaronic order, doesn't it? And so this promise, like others, would be conditional upon faithfulness, where disobedience could result in forfeiture. And so the priesthood, the everlasting priesthood that was promised to the house of Aaron, was lost. Well, it was at least lost to the house of Phinehas, to the line of Phinehas, for five generations. It stayed with him for five generations. It was lost to the house of Ithamar for five generations, and then it came back to the house of Phinehas subsequently. And you know, once the priesthood reverted back in the days of David through the line of Zadok, who was of course of the line of Phinehas, once the priesthood came back to the line of Phinehas through Eleazar, do you know that that family, the family of Phinehas, held the covenant of the priesthood for the rest of the Jewish age? It never ever departed from them subsequently. Throughout the period of the kings, throughout the time of the Babylonian captivity, the return of the exile, the dominion of Persia, the rulership of Greece, the advance of Rome, throughout all of that time, the family of Phinehas held the high priesthood without change. Now, when did the Jewish Olam finish? When did the Jewish age come to an end? A.D. 70. Do you know who the last high priest was? The very last high priest when the Jewish age came to an end? Well, he was the son of Samuel of the village of Apthar, a man appointed by the Zealots. And you'd never guess his name, would you? His name was Phinehas. So, you see, this priesthood after the order of Aaron ran from Phinehas right through to Phinehas. Throughout the whole Jewish Olam, I give him the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, and he shall have it, and his seed after him. So, you see, I think there is a genuine sense in which we can take the promise of Numbers 25 and say that this was outworked in the Aaronic order itself. This family would hold this promise, this covenant, this priesthood throughout the Jewish age. And yet, having said that, of course, although there's undoubtedly a fulfillment of the promise into the Aaronic order, doesn't one feel uneasy if one was to close the book on Numbers 25 and say, here endeth the matter? That somehow that doesn't seem to take up the full grandeur of the promise that has been made. That this is not the full story, this is not the end of the story. That the word and the language of Numbers 25 seems to argue something better, something higher, does it not, than just the Aaronic order? And so now we're going to look at the fulfillment of the same promise in the sense of it being a promise of the Melchizedek priesthood. So let's see if we can work this idea through. Now, remember what I've said, this is not a logical sequence, so you don't have to try and follow a line of argument here. There is none. It's just a selection of ideas. And every one of these in isolation you might count as not being of substance. But somehow, when you put all these little dabs together, you think, oh, there's a painting here. That this promise is clearly a promise that extends into the immortal priesthood of the age to come. Well, let's start with this idea. You see, really, it's quite unsatisfying, isn't it, to imagine that the promise of Numbers 25 is simply only the promise of the order to Aaron, because, you see, what that would be saying is this. What it would be saying is that God says, Phinehas, You have been very zealous for my sake. And because of your zeal and because of your faithfulness, I'll give you a special promise. You can have the covenant I've already given your granddad. That's not special really, is it? Since the family already held that promise through Aaron. Now, there must be something more than that in terms of the covenant. And if it was truly, you know, if it was truly something special to Phinehas, and yet would only be outworked through the Aaronic order, what would one make of this? That in Numbers 25, a man called Phinehas is given the promise of an everlasting priesthood, and the very next priest in the Bible, whose name of course is Eli, is not of the house of Phinehas at all, and he's already lost it. Not much of an everlasting priesthood, was it? And the very fact that the priesthood has changed to the other line by the time the next priest appears in the Bible surely argues something for the fact that whatever the everlasting promise of Numbers 25 was, that it was not simply to be seen through the natural seed. It argues that there must be some other basis to the promise and to the fulfillment of the promise. You know, the word everlasting. Come back to Genesis 17. Here's the promise to Abraham. Now, you see how we take up the idea of everlasting when we look at promises. Let's just have a look at the promise to Abraham and the promise to David. Now, in Genesis 17, we're told this in the seventh verse. It says there, I'll establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee and their generations for an everlasting covenant to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee, and I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession. So here we have an everlasting covenant and an everlasting possession. And so we ask this question, was there a fulfillment of this promise to Abraham through the natural seed? Did they possess the land everlastingly in their generations? And the answer is yes, they did. And so they will in the kingdom age, says Brother Thomas, in the mystery of the covenant, that although mortal, the people of Jewry will hold the land forever in their successive generations. So there was a possession of the land through the natural seed. And yet we say, of course, that's not the fulfillment really of the promise to Abraham. There's another layer. There's another seed. There's a spiritual seed. And they will inherit the land of promise on a truly everlasting basis, for they will be immortal. The natural seed fulfilled the promise in a sense that they inherited the land, but they eventually lost the promise through unfaithfulness. The immortal seed will truly inherit on an everlasting basis. Now, do we say that about the promise to Abraham? Two layers, the natural seed and the spiritual seed, two lines of application to the promise? Yes, I think we do. What about the promise to David, Isaiah 55? Now, Isaiah 55, it says in verse 3, incline your ear and come unto me, hear and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant. See, it's the same phrase, you see, an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David. Now, what was the promise to David? Well, it was the promise of rulership, wasn't it? Was there a fulfillment through the natural seed of David that they became the aristocracy of Israel? And the answer is yes. Were they the rulers? Yes. Did they eventually forfeit the promise of an everlasting covenant through unfaithfulness? Yes. But is there also a spiritual seed of David, another layer, another application to the promise? Yes. Will there be an aristocracy of the age to come? Who will be the royal seed of the everlasting covenant made with David? Who will be the kings of the age to come immortally? Yes. So were there two layers to the promise? Yes. So now, what about the promise to Phinehas of an everlasting priesthood? Was there a fulfillment through the natural seed of the priestly line? Yes. And the house of Aaron held that promise. Did they eventually lose it through unfaithfulness? Yes. Is there also another layer? Is there a spiritual seed of priestly line? Yes. Who will be priests in the age to come and who will hold the promise of the covenant of an everlasting priesthood throughout the kingdom age because of immortality? Yes. So you see, each one of these great promises has two layers, two levels, doesn't it? There's a natural seed and there's a spiritual seed. There is an earnest of the fulfillment with the natural seed, but there is a spiritual offspring of Abraham and a spiritual offspring of David and a spiritual offspring of Phinehas, who shall be the final fulfillment of these three promises? Yes, I think so. So therefore, the promise of the priesthood to Phinehas, we would argue, therefore, that if the everlasting covenant of Abraham and the everlasting covenant of David are going to extend into the kingdom age, then won't the everlasting covenant to Phinehas extend into the kingdom age itself in the matter of priesthood? And the answer is yes, of course it must. Now, think about this. Now, here's a very interesting thought, brothers and sisters. You remember this story in Leviticus 10, which, again, we won't turn up this morning, but you remember that Leviticus 8 and 9 and 10 is the story of the inauguration of Aaron as a priest. You know, by the way, I think those chapters are more than just the inauguration of Aaron as a priest. It was actually the inauguration of the priesthood after the order of Aaron. Did that ceremony ever happen again? Was every high priest inaugurated after the manner of Leviticus 8 and 9 and 10? The answer is no, it never happened again. That consecration ceremony never occurred again. The ceremony of Leviticus 8 to 10 was the inauguration of the priesthood after the order of Aaron. And what happened to that priesthood on the very day of its inauguration? Why, there was tragedy. There was disaster, there was corruption, the first high priest-elect died. Now, aren't we being told, therefore, in the divine record, that from the very moment of the inauguration of the Aaronic order, that this priesthood was flawed? It had failure at the very moment of its beginning. God intended to introduce another priesthood from that moment. Now, ask yourself this question then. What is the soonest possible moment of time in the divine record that God can intimate a new order of priesthood to come? Well, it can't be in the days of Aaron, can it? Because he's a priest after the order of Aaron. And it probably can't really be in the days of Eleazar, because, you see, Eleazar has to come and he has to be a high priest after the order of Aaron, so that there is an order of Aaron. There's no order of Aaron unless there's a priest that succeeds in that office so that an order can be established. So what's the soonest possible moment of time in the divine record that God could intimate that there would be another priesthood to come? And the answer is in the life of a man called Phinehas. Of course, Melchizedek's mentioned before Aaron in the record, isn't he? But not the order of Melchizedek. The order of Melchizedek is mentioned after the order of Aaron, isn't it? It comes after. You know, in the law of Moses, brothers and sisters, this is another thought, by the way, so we're just moving through our kaleidoscope, you see. In the law of Moses, the law said that the high priest would have to marry a virgin from his own tribe of the house of Levi. But you see, before that law was instituted and enshrined, Aaron was already married. Do you know who Aaron married? Oh, actually, I've jumped the gun here. Let me read you some words, firstly, from a place in the Bible. I'll read the words, and you can tell me where they come from. Are you ready? For the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law. For he of whom these things are spoken pertaineth to another tribe, of which no man gave attendance at the altar, for it is evident that our Lord sprang out of Judah, of which tribe Moses spake nothing concerning priesthood. Quotation from, yes, the book of Hebrews, chapter 7. Do you know, 11 to 14 would be very good. Very, very acceptable. Now, who did Aaron marry? Does anybody know? He married a woman called Elisheba. You know who Elisheba was? She was actually the brother of... No, she wasn't. She wasn't. I retract that. She was the sister, definitely the sister, now I come to think about it, the more I come to think about it, she was the sister of a man called Nahashon. Do you know who Nahashon was? He was the prince of the tribe of Judah. So Elisheba was a daughter of Judah, and she married Aaron. Now Hebrews says that our Lord sprang from Judah, of which tribe Moses spake nothing concerning priesthood. But in the life of the man whom God would be pleased to show, to intimate a new priesthood which was to come, a man called Phinehas, through the blood of his grandmother, there flowed in his veins the blood of Judah in this boy. Isn't that interesting? Now come to Psalm 106. Sorry, Psalm 106. Actually, what you need to do is turn up Psalm 106 and also Numbers 25 so that you've got both of those records together side by side. So if you can turn both of those up simultaneously. Now, do you know that there are three stages, really, to the book of Numbers and chapter 25? There are three great stages to the story of Numbers 25. The first thing is that apostasy was shown. Now, where's that in Numbers 25? That's really verses 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Apostasy. Now, the second great stage is that faithful action saved the nation. Now, that's really verse 7, 8, and 9, isn't it? The intervention of Phinehas in Numbers 25. And the third thing that is that as a result of that, a promise was made. So that's verses 10 to 13, isn't it, in Numbers 25. You see those three basic sections? The introduction of apostasy, verses 1 to 6, the faithful action that saved the nation, verses 7 to 9, and the promise or reward given as a result of that, verses 10 to 13. Now, I'd like you to see those three sections in Psalm 106. So, firstly, verse 28. Here's the first part. They joined themselves also unto Baal Peor, and ate the sacrifices of the dead. Thus they provoked him to anger with their inventions, and the plague brake in upon them. You see, Psalm 106 is an inspired commentary on Numbers 25. So there's the first section, the introduction of apostasy, Psalm 106, verses 28 and 29. All right, now what's the next section from Numbers? The faithful action of Phinehas that saved the nation. Well, that's got to be verse 30, doesn't it? Then stood up Phinehas and executed judgment, and so the plague was stayed. Now, what's the third section of Numbers? The giving of a promise as a reward. I give unto him the promise of an everlasting priesthood. What's the equivalent of that in Psalm 106, verse 31? And that was counted unto him for righteousness unto all generations forevermore. Now, this is a truly remarkable verse when you think, I have to say this, brothers and sisters, this was the verse that finally convinced me of the stature of Phinehas. Yes, he was a passionate man, and sometimes his zeal led him to do those things that maybe he ought not to have done. But the overall summation of his life is that God loved this man and approved of him. And here's the proof. Psalm 106, verse 31. Now, just have a look at this. Where does this phrase come from? It was counted unto him for righteousness. Where have you heard that phrase before? That's Genesis 15 and the faith of Abraham, isn't it? Do you know that these are the only two men in the Bible of whom that saying is recorded? It was counted unto him for righteousness. But you notice the difference. You see, in Genesis 15, what's counted unto Abraham for righteousness is his faith. But in Psalm 106, what's counted unto Phineas for righteousness is his works. It's the other side of the ledger, but they are, of course, works of faith. So that if we had at all any doubts about the purity of the motive of Phineas in Numbers 25, we need have no doubts. God himself approves absolutely of the reason why Phineas acted as he did in Numbers 25. His motive was pure. It was counted unto him for righteousness. Now, what's really interesting about this phrase is this, brothers and sisters, that the Apostle Paul forever immortalizes the power of that phrase, counted unto him for righteousness, because of how Paul expounds that in Romans 4. Now, I'm not going to take you to Romans 4, I'm just going to summarize Romans 4 for you. But you know what the Apostle Paul says? He basically says this. He says, the man who stands before God where either his faith or his faithful works are counted for righteousness is the man to whom God will not impute sin. And you see, the man to whom God will not impute sin is the man who can be given immortality. Because the prerequisite before God that eternal life might be granted unto us is that we must first be justified before our God, and we can only be justified before our God when we stand without sin before him. So this phrase, counted unto him for righteousness, is really the promise eventually of immortality. This is what leads to immortality. What Phineas, I believe, is promised in Psalm 106 in verse 31 is the promise ultimately of immortality by being counted righteous before his God. And you notice how strong the expression is in Psalm 106. It was counted unto him for righteousness unto all generations forevermore. You see, this is an extraordinarily powerful statement, isn't it? This is the promise of immortality to this man. Now stop and think about this, brothers and sisters. If the promise... Now remember, Psalm 106 is a commentary on Numbers 25. If the promise of Numbers 25 is the promise to Phineas of eternal life, then what must the covenant of the priesthood of Numbers 25 be? But the promise of an eternal priesthood. Is that not true? If eternal life is the promise of Psalm 106, then it must be an eternal priesthood. In Numbers 25, was counted unto him for righteousness, counted unto him for Zadok is the meaning of the word. Again, brothers and sisters, in Hebrews chapter 7, which we won't turn to, in verses 16 and 17, this is another thought now, you see. One of the great features of the Melchizedek order is that the Aaronic order appointed priests by succession, didn't they? Every priest after the order of Aaron succeeded to office by lineal succession, by fleshly descent. What's the great feature, however, of Melchizedek order in terms of appointment that makes it different to the Aaronic? And the answer is that the appointment of the Melchizedek order is based on, firstly, divine approval and based on the intrinsic righteousness and the personal holiness of the person, not fleshly descent. In other words, this is a priesthood that is not simply given because you're the son of someone else or the successor of the office, but you are worthy of the office because of the virtues of your character. That's the basis of the appointment to the Melchizedek order, says Hebrews 7, verses 16 and 17. Now think about the promise to Phinehas. It says this, Numbers 25, "He hath been zealous for my sake, wherefore I give him a covenant." So you see that the very basis of the promise of priesthood to Phinehas in Numbers 25 is not because he's the successor of Eleazar, but because of his personal righteousness, because he's done this, therefore I give him a covenant. You see what Psalm 106 says? Psalm 106 says that he executed judgment before God, and that was counted unto him for righteousness. The reward that's given to him is predicated upon the worth of his character. Psalm 45 says, "Thou lovest righteousness and hatest iniquity, therefore God hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows." You see, Phinehas was a priest who was given his priesthood because of the worth of his character, not because of fleshly descent, and that's the very characteristic of the Melchizedek order. Actually, even Malachi... this is another thought, by the way, you see, so we're moving on. Even Malachi has Melchizedek overtones when you think about it, because, you know, Malachi says of this hero, this champion, it says, "He walked with me in peace and equity." Now, the word equity in Malachi is not the word Zadok, but it is a synonym for the word Zadok. It means righteousness. It means uprightness. He walked with me in peace and righteousness. What are the two great qualities of the Melchizedek order? He's the king of Salem, king of peace, and he's Melchizedek, he's king of righteousness. "He walked with me in peace and righteousness," says Malachi. Those are definite overtones of the Melchizedek order, aren't they? Now, here's another thought for you. Of course, you know, every truly everlasting covenant in the Bible is confirmed as such by one notable thing. What might that be? It's not just a promise, it's not just a covenant, it must be sworn with an oath. Now, is the covenant to Phinehas ever sworn with an oath? The answer is yes, it is. Now, where might that be? Why, it's in Psalm 110. Now, come and have a look at this very carefully. Now, we know the promise of Psalm 110. It says, verse 1, "Yahweh said unto my Adon, sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. Yahweh shall send the rod of thy strength out of Zion, rule thou in the midst of thine enemies." There's a coming king. Verse 3, "Thy people shall be willing in the day of thy power, in the beauties of holiness. From the womb of the morning thou hast the dew of thy youth." Now, this is interesting, you see, the third verse. It says that there's going to be a group of people who are really the supporters of the priest. And they are like a spiritual army. They're all clad in the beauties of holiness. That's the priestly garments, isn't it? So, you see, here is a group of people all willing in the day of the power of the leader. Who, by the way, derives his power from the womb of the morning and the dew of youth. In other words, the womb of the morning, resurrection, to immortality, the dew of youth. You see, the great basis of the Melchizedek order is resurrection to immortality. So here he is, verse 4. "Yahweh hath sworn and will not repent. Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." Now you see, the oath is made here, not with Phinehas, but with the high priest of the order to which Phinehas belongs. There is only one immortal priesthood, is there not? And if Phinehas is promised the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, it can be none other than the Melchizedek order. But you see, the oath is made not with Phinehas, but with the high priest of that order. Because you see, only with the resurrection of Christ could this order be established. And even Phinehas can only be involved with this priesthood after that. But he's the great prototype, you see. Phinehas is the great prototype of the Melchizedek order. Now, you see, we've all read Psalm 110 many times, haven't we? Let me ask you to read it again. Have you noticed this? So here's a high priest, after the order of Melchizedek. What's he like, this priest? Verse 5. Yahweh, at thy right hand, shall strike through kings in the day of his wrath. He shall judge among the heathen. He shall fill the places with the dead bodies. He shall wound the heads over many countries. You know, brothers and sisters, the priest of Psalm 110 is a warrior priest. Did you notice that? He's a warrior priest who goes forth and he fights the battles of Yahweh. You see the words? Strike, verse 5. Judge, verse 6. Wound, verse 6. He's a warrior priest. Who is the great warrior priest of the Old Testament? But Phinehas. Is he not? Just hold your hand in Psalm 110 and come back to Numbers 31 for a moment. Allow me just to show you something in Numbers 31. Yahweh at thy right hand, the right hand of this priest, shall strike through kings in the day of his wrath, says Psalm 110 concerning this priest. Numbers 31, verse 6. Moses sent them to the war, 1,000 of every tribe, 12,000 men, and Phinehas the son of Eleazar the priest, verse 7. They warred against the Midianites, as Yahweh commanded Moses, and they slew all the males, and they slew the kings. Yahweh shall strike through kings, says the son. They slew the kings. How many did they slay? Verse 8. They slew 5 plus Balaam. They slew 6 heroes of the flesh. And 12,000 men, representing an immortal army of Israelites, went forth with this man Phinehas as a priestly warrior at their head. And they won an amazing victory. Do you know how amazing the victory of Numbers 31 was? Verse 49. They said unto Moses after the war, thy servants have taken the sum of the men of war which are under our charge. And you know what? There lacketh not one man. You see, when they went forth under this priest, they were an invincible army. They never lost a man. They were like immortals. Under this man, Phinehas, the warrior priest. I think you see that the shadow of Phinehas lies upon the promise of the priesthood of Psalm 110. Does he not, brothers and sisters? Can you see him there? And so the priest, after the eternal order of Melchizedek, is a warrior priest for God's righteousness, who executes God's judgments upon the unfaithful and the unholy, and I think that's all modelled on Phinehas. And we've already seen, haven't we, in our study yesterday, how that Phinehas and the sons of Korah become the prototype of the prince of Ezekiel and the sons of Zadok, who are his spiritual offspring, a priestly leader and his spiritual offspring. You know, one of the greatest features of the promise to Melchizedek is that, unlike the Levitical order, the order of Melchizedek is a royal order. And if you come to Ezekiel, you'll find that one of the great features of that order is that because it is royal as well as spiritual, that there is a difference between the two with respect to the ownership of land. Now, you'll remember this in Ezekiel 45, and verses 7 and 8, it says this.
Ezekiel 45 and verses 7 and 8. It says, a portion shall be for the prince on the one side and on the other side of the oblation of the holy portion and of the possession of the city. Verse 8, in the land shall be his possession in Israel. Now we know that this prince offers sacrifices and that this prince is in fact the priest, that he is in fact the priest of the order. This is Melchizedek, this is Melchizedek. But you see, this priest owns land. Do you notice that? And so do his sons, because if you come over the page to chapter 46 and verse 16, it says, if the prince give a gift unto any of his sons, the inheritance thereof shall be his sons, and it shall be their possession. So you see, both the high priest of this order and his priestly offspring own land. And that is in contrast to the order of Levi, because even in the kingdom age, Ezekiel 44 and verse 28 says, it shall be unto them for an inheritance. I am their inheritance, and ye shall give them, the order of Levi, no possession in Israel. So you see that Levi's realm was always counted as being spiritual, not temporal. They had no earthly inheritance of land. But one of the great features, you see, of the Melchizedek order is because it's royal as well, that they have royal privileges and they have royal possessions. And so the high priest of this new order owns land in his own right. And do you know that there just happens to be one high priest in ancient times who actually owned land in his own right? And you'd never guess who that might be, would you? Would you like to see that? Joshua chapter 24. In Joshua 24 and verse 33, it says, and Eleazar the son of Aaron died, and they buried him in a hill that pertained to Phinehas his son, which was given him in Mount Ephraim. Now you see the word given here, it's a very common word, but it happens to be the word used throughout the book of Deuteronomy and throughout the book of Joshua for Israel being given their inheritance, given their land, given their possession. And here is a piece of land that was given to Phinehas. He actually owned this land. No other high priest owned land. The priests had no inheritance. Levi, over and over again, the law says they have no inheritance. But this one man owned a piece of land, you see. Now, stop and think about this, brothers and sisters. Verse 33, if he buried his father in this piece of land, then I think it's reasonable to assume that he probably owned it before his father died. Would it not? In which case, when he received that land, he was not the high priest, was he? He was the high priest to come. And as the high priest which was for to come, this one man in ancient Israelitish history had a block of land that he possessed. Isn't that interesting? Of course you might say, oh well, that's yes, but that could be just part of the normal allotment that was given to the house of Aaron. No, it wasn't actually, because the first of Chronicles, chapter 6, verses 54 and 60 tells us that the allotment that fell to the house of Aaron came in the tribes of Judah and Simeon and Benjamin. But this parcel of land was in Mount Ephraim. It was specially given to Phinehas as a mark of the nation's esteem. It's shown to this very day at a place called Awerta, 4 miles southeast of Shechem. You see, there's all these foreshadowings, isn't there, in the life of Phinehas, in the story of Phinehas, that inevitably, inexorably lead us to the notion that this is the Melchizedek order that will be associated with this man. Now, on your overheads for this session, there is an overhead that refers to the great covenants of promise. It's called simply the covenants of promise. So let's compare the promise to Phinehas now with at least the promises made to David and to Abraham. So you see, each of these promises is made sure by God in that he seals it in the form of a covenant blessing. To each of these men is given not just a promise, but a promise so strong that it's couched in this word, "I give unto thee a covenant." And each of these promises is made to a notable individual who is famous for an outstanding characteristic. What's the great feature of Abram's life? His faith. What's the great feature of the life of Phinehas? His zeal. What's the great virtue of the man David? His mercy. And to each of these famous men who were outstanding for a particular characteristic, a special promise, you see, is made. Each promise is couched in the language of futurity and always involves, does it not, a future seed. The seed, the seed, the seed. Always there, isn't it, in these promises? Including the covenant to Phinehas. Did you notice that in Numbers 25? "Wherefore I give it unto him and to his seed after him." And each promise is sworn with an oath, which of course relates the matter to God's eternal purpose. In fact, I wrote something down about these three covenants. The promise to Abraham. Faith in God's power brings the blessing of ownership. Ownership is the promise of possession, of security, and of permanence. The promise to Phinehas is that zeal for God's holiness brings the honor of fellowship. And fellowship is the promise of unity, the promise of harmony, and the promise of peace. That which is made to David is that the love of God's mercy brings the privilege of rulership. And rulership is the promise of authority, the promise of control, and of governance. You see, I think the promise to Phinehas, and this is what we're saying, isn't it, brothers and sisters? I think the promise to Phinehas is a very special one indeed, the covenant that is made with this man. I think it reaches forward into the very kingdom age itself. And you know what it is ultimately the promise of? It's called a covenant of peace. Do you know what that's really a promise of? The covenant of peace, the covenant of an everlasting priesthood. I think it's the promise of fellowship with God. Of being able to come into fellowship with God. That's ultimately what it's all about. He was a great man, brothers and sisters, was this man Phinehas. And so, really, our study of Phinehas has been a study in zeal, hasn't it? To study Phinehas is to study the idea of zeal. And you see, I think it's good that we do this for this reason, brothers and sisters, and perhaps especially young people, is because zeal is no longer fashionable. You don't want to be zealous for anything. We live in a world that says, look, if you can get away without putting any effort in, so much the better. We live in an age where everything... The only passion of the present age is for mediocrity. But the Bible and the notion of the divine qualities of the deity whom we worship is all about passion and excellence, isn't it? And I think that God loved this man, you see, because of his zeal. And because he was special, he was given a special covenant of promise that takes him into the very kingdom age itself as part of an immortal priesthood because of that zeal that he had for his God. I think, brothers and sisters, we live in an age where we ought to practice, we need to practice, we need to see zeal in our lives, in our ecclesias, in our families. It's a great virtue that's lacking. And so what have we seen then as we've traversed the life of this man, these few fragments of this mysterious man? Well, we've seen that zeal is related to the virtue of holiness, that one must learn that purity of principle and purity of practice walk side by side. Compromise the one and you will inevitably affect the other. And that therefore zeal, the zeal that we ought to have, is that zeal that will cause us to uphold at all costs, as best as we are able, with grace, with wisdom, but with firmness, divine principles. We must be zealous about that. We've got to learn zeal for the holiness which is of God, that the great promise of Scripture is to be able to draw near to Him, but that God has said, God has commanded, that those who desire to draw near to Him must first be sanctified, and I believe that God will not allow any of us to draw near to Him if we are not holy. We cannot find Him. He is hid from the profane. He's invisible to the corrupt. Only those who are truly zealous for His holiness will ever draw near God. Have you ever found Him, brothers and sisters? Have you ever truly come into His presence? We must be zealous for that, and that's what this man was. And then we saw that zeal is related to the spirit of faithfulness, that we've got to learn to love righteousness and to abhor wickedness. We live in an age where it's easy to love righteousness on Sundays, and the great challenge is whether we abhor the wickedness of the world in the days that follow. And I think, brothers and sisters, I believe that we're living at a time of crisis in the ecclesial world where divine principles are being compromised. And where there are many who say they love righteousness, but there appears to be some doubt about whether we really abhor the wickedness of the age in which we live. And we give ourselves to unholy things. To unholy music, to unholy sights, to unholy books, to unholy pleasures, and we pretend that we can still draw near to God, and we cannot, brothers and sisters, He's promised us that we cannot. Oh yes, I think that there is I think we need the zeal of Phineas, you see, of a man who's prepared to stand for divine principles in the spirit of faithfulness. And we need to learn to do that, to stand properly for divine principles. Yes, we've got to learn the balance between mercy and judgment, to know that God's character is positive, to be faithful to all His principles, but we need to learn to stand for them. And I think there's a need for that right now in ecclesial life. I think principles are being eroded. I think young people are going out and doing things that we did not do 20 years ago. And we need some zeal, don't we, to uphold divine principles. What about zeal and the wisdom of temperance? Did we not see that those perhaps particularly who are zealous and who are passionate, that they have a greater need to be careful with their words? That they need to take thought for the consequences of what they do and how they say it. That they need to seek reconciliation. And that they need to understand that their zeal must be tempered with the virtue of restraint, so that the truth can truly prosper as best as it might. And then we saw, didn't we, in the worst moment of Phineas's life, zeal and the danger of vengeance. and how we need to learn that zeal, when taken to extremity, becomes simply destructive, that the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God, that passion unrestrained can so easily transmute itself from divine judgment to purely human vengeance, and that this does not serve the truth, nor advance the purpose of our Father. And so we need to remember, don't we, in moments when we're perhaps the most incensed, the most outraged at things that go on in ecclesial life, and sometimes there are things that deeply upset us, we need always to remember this, do we not, with the spirit of zeal, that true zeal is measured not by the number of those slain, but by the number of those saved. And that's where zeal finds its greatest power, the power of example, that zeal that enthuses others, a zeal not just to hate wickedness, but to nourish good, a zeal to light the flame in the next generation, a zeal to inspire our children, to enthuse others. That this is the greatest work of zeal that we can have within our own lives and for the benefit of others. Do we not need more in ecclesial life of that spirit, the power of example, the one to the other, that we might inspire each other towards holy things? And finally, this day, in the matter of the promise of the priesthood, I think we come to zeal and the honour of fellowship. And we've got to remember that zeal is a God-centred thing, that the focus of our zeal should be on our highest aspiration, which is to approach God himself, to come before the deity and to find fellowship with him. And that therefore our zeal, brothers and sisters, must always be for that which best advances the divine purpose. I'd like you to come to your overheads and let's just read together the summary sheet for the session this morning, entitled Zeal and the Honour of Fellowship. Zeal is a quality of God. For Yahweh, whose name is zealous, is a zealous God. Those who reflect his qualities, he receives unto himself. The covenant of priesthood made with Phinehas was the promise of an incorruptible nature that removes any impediment to fellowship with God. The privilege of drawing near to him surely belongs to those who have been guardians of his holiness now. To Phinehas and his seed is given the honour of fellowship, the pure garment, the change to spirit light, the joy of ascending the hill of Yahweh, the intimacy of seeing him face to face as everlasting possessors of righteousness. Who would not be zealous for the joy of this honour? Who indeed, but now where do all those words come from, brothers and sisters? Because really they come from in hymn. Now what hymn is it, and where in the divine record does the hymn come from? It's hymn 240, with which we shall close, and it's based on what Bible passage, which we of course should all have marked in our hymn book. Anyone know? It's Psalm 24, isn't it? That's right. So maybe we might just turn to that hymn, shall we, to close, as we bring our thoughts together. Hymn 240. And what a delightful hymn to summarize the thoughts of our study on this interesting man. There's not really a lot on him, is there, brothers and sisters? And yet there's enough, isn't there? Enough to feel that the divine record has preserved his life so that we might learn somewhat from him. And the hymn says, most glorious things are spoken, Jerusalem, of thee. Because, you see, in the age to come, brothers and sisters, when that royal priesthood is finally established, it will be in Jerusalem that it will be seen, and it will be in Jerusalem that that priesthood shall minister. And what is the promise of that priesthood to all God's saints? The token of love and liberty, freedom, brothers and sisters, from all the weaknesses of the flesh. Who shall thy hill ascending? Because you see, this is the promise of priesthood, isn't it? Doesn't the prophecy of Ezekiel say that only the sons of Zadok can draw near? Only the sons of Zadok can ascend up the hill? Only they can come nigh to God? Isn't that the promise that's given to us? And who might they be? Well, they can only be those who are immortalized, brothers and sisters, after the manner of the promise to Phinehas. Those who, in the words of the hymn, shall finally be from pain and sorrow free, free forever from sin and death contending, the living glory be. This is the promise to those who are counted as the seed of Phinehas in that day, who shall receive the pebble, the raiment pure and white. These are the linen robes of this new high priestly order, no charred bodies within, of those who corrupt divine principle, those who assert their own preeminence. Never again shall that be seen, not with this group of priests. They shall be forever faithful as they are changed to spirit light and take on them the holy name of Ael. And who might these be, brothers and sisters and young people, who shall share in the glorious promise of these things? Why, he who has hands of cleanness, whose heart abides in truth, whose soul abhors to leanness the vanities of youth, those that have learned to love righteousness and to hate wickedness. After the manner of Phinehas of old, they shall have the hope of these things. Verse 3, he shall receive the blessing of Yahweh's saving grace and righteousness possess. It was counted unto him for righteousness, unto all generations forevermore. The sons of Zadok are they who shall possess that righteousness, are they not? And what is the promise to them, to us? We, brothers and sisters, but the unbelievable hope that one day we shall enter into fellowship with God in such intimacy as royal priests, that we might see Him face to face. Yes, wondrous things are spoken, Jerusalem, of thee. The oath of this immortal priesthood, of the covenant with Phinehas, this oath cannot be broken. And we, its joys, shall see, and so we shall, brothers and sisters, if we take up the zeal of Phinehas and the balance of Christ. We may one day be there in the mercy of our Father and see Him face to face. Such are some of the lessons that we take concerning the life and times of a man called Phinehas.